This is Hacker Public Radio, episode 3829 for Thursday, the 6th of April, 2023. Today's show is entitled, The Edinburgh Cohort of Hacker Public Radio Hosts Stop Mumbling. It is hosted by Dave Morris and is about 55 minutes long. It carries an explicit flag. The summary is, Dave Morris and Mr. X talk about various technical topics.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Hacker Public Radio. And today we're recording in Studio C, my Citroen car. And I'm here with Mr. X.
Hello, everybody.
And we've just had a brunch in the pub that's just across from us.
And I must say, it was marvellous.
Yeah, it was good, wasn't it?
A good Scottish haggis roll was consumed.
And they only serve breakfast up until midday, I think. And we got there a little early for anything else.
And then, of course, the table that was booked for soon after we arrived, so we couldn't wait for the main meal But it turned out to be very nice, but I don't think I've ever had a haggis roll with so many slices of haggis on it. I mean, it was just ridiculous.
Yep. You've got your money's worth, eh?
Yeah.
That's good. Anyway, so what we're planning to do is to just do a little bit of a chat. We've got a sort of agenda, which we may or may not adhere to, I don't know.
Yes,
And we'll just sort of play it by ear and see how we get on.
Do you have your notes? Are you going to...
I've only got the one copy.
Oh, well, then you do that.
Okay.
And I can look at my tablet.
Okay.
See, we're super organized here, you can tell.
Yeah, we have to leave that in. You know, it just shows that our studio management is not absolutely on point.
So, the first thing we talked about was, is email still relevant in 2022? Well, it should be 2023, I suppose, really. But,
Well, that's right. Yeah, I changed that to 2023 last night, but never mind.
Oh, yeah, I missed that. It's amazing how useful these, we tend to do this thing using just for the convenience of a Google Docs.
Mm-hmm.
But that is a really handy way of sharing things, you know. And
it is a really good way of doing stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Just as an aside, shall I say about that? I was struggling to do a copy and paste in this document.
Mm.
And I looked it up and it said, if you're using Firefox, which I don't use Google Chrome, if you're using Firefox and it don't work. And then I found somebody that said, well, here's how you fix it. You go to the about config.
Well, you've got that, have you?
Yeah, in a new tab.
Right.
And that gives you access to all of the settings in the browser.
Yeah.
And you change, and I'll put it in the notes, dom.event.clipboard events, which I spelt wrong, dot enabled, and you set that to true. So that enables you to use the machine's clipboard to cut stuff out and then paste it back in again.
I mean, it's absolutely ridiculous, isn't it?
It's disgusting that they've turned that off.
We don't want you to use it. We want to dissuade you from using Firefox or some other browser that are on ours, so therefore they do that.
We can't surveil you enough for using those. Anyway, so that's we'll put that in as a note. I'm sure other people have already been down this path if they care about it. And that's probably not
I used to use Firefox all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I've just somehow started using, and it wasn't for that reason, but I ended up using Chrome, you know, so I think I use Chrome more often than not now.
Yeah.
But, and you can see why these sort of things.
I stopped using it in the past sort of year, 18 months, because I just didn't like the whole Google approach
to
the
world. I understand that,
So, anyway, but that's a little bit off track. So, is email still relevant is really the question we were kicking around, wasn't it?
I think, as I said, I do remember the big thing that Google made about that email is now no longer relevant and we should be using something different. For example, Google Wave, I think it was. And that was going to be the next big thing and the big hoo-ha about it all and all that. And I think I vaguely opened the app and that's as far as I went. But you do feel in some ways that there must be a better way of dealing with things in emails, but... it's just the way the modern do things now.
Well,
I don't know.
I do not like Google Mail at all. I don't use it, except that I do use it.
It's just a convenience factor. For some people, email it's fine, you know. But
Well, See, what I discovered relatively early on, because I was an early adopter of Gmail, before it got called Google Mail in Britain, not elsewhere. Right, right. I don't know quite what was going on there. Anyway, I discovered that I use Thunderbird. I've been using Thunderbird for, I don't know, 15 years or something. And I use Thunderbird to read pop mail, which I get from my ISP for some reason, and IMAP mail. And I found that there was an IMAP route into your Gmail. So I set that up. Mm. I think there were warnings that they were going to take that away at some point, but they never have.
Right.
In fact, they were sort of fairly supportive of people continuing with it, I imagine, because a lot of people are. And if you use that, then your mail client will pull down your mail, and you won't get all the damned ads that you get.
Good idea.
And you're not getting all that label nonsense, which I really don't want.
Yeah.
So I just put everything in my inbox on Gmail and then use Thunderbird to pull everything off, and then I file it locally into folders and all that sort of stuff, you know.
I think I'm really quite disorganized. I just let it all come into the inbox and just keep it simple, because I know that a colleague at work, he used to have, you know, I used to, and now I can appreciate, because work's a bit of a nightmare now and I get so many emails, but at the time I couldn't see the point of having different folders. He was forever saying, I'm looking for this email, is it in that folder, is it in this folder, is it? It's just stick it in a damn inbox and you know it's there, you can find the thing, you know. But with the amount of emails I'm getting, I'm getting to the stage where I'm thinking, well, maybe I need to do something like that. But funny you should talk about that. I'm going to go off on a complete different tangent, but to do with email. And it was a video I was watching, was it Tom Scott, is that the chap? And he was saying that he had situation, probably won't do this justice because it's all from memory, but he had a situation where he said, you know, people of a certain age, they're used to putting emails into folders, and that's how he deals with things. And he was saying that obviously now the current generation think of things from a label point of view, so how can you deal with that? And so I think he'd gone from one system to Gmail, I can't remember, something like that anyway. And I said, well, if I just think about a folder as being a label, then that solves it. But what he discovered was that I'm not doing this justice, but it was something to do when they transferred it over. Obviously, I had millions of emails or whatever. And what he found was the emails that were nested within it didn't go, but he only found it out much later on. So you had years of emails missing. You didn't realize it. We're going to solve this.
I think I've seen this episode, actually. And I think he was talking about threads.
That thread.
I think you labeled the start of a thread, but
that
all of the messages in the thread weren't labeled, and the software that was doing it didn't understand the label for the thread was to apply to all the messages in the thread.
That's it, spot on.
So I know I did watch that relatively recently, and was amazed that there would only be anything that stupid. I can see the label thing is quite useful, because a label is a thing that you apply to an email regardless of where it is or where it's come from.
And you can apply multiple labels.
So
you can, and that's a problem that my colleague had, whereby you say, well, is it in this folder? It can't be in two folders at once, but it can be in two labels. So that's the advantage, I guess.
No, it does have strong advantages there. I started writing loads of stuff here when I was thinking about this yesterday, and partly to say I actually came to email in the very early days, where we had Unix stuff in early 90s, something like that. We started moving towards Unix, and we had the SMTP mail at that point. The mail clients available on Unix were pretty scarce. There were two, maybe three. There was the bin mail, which came as standard with your Unix system. Which then
touched on that, but never really used it. But
I think it used mailbox format. I can't remember what format it was.
There was something I did, and my system was sending me emails to the bin thing, so that a system can do that within Linux. I can't remember what it was. It was some script I'd written, and I was getting automated telling me this was the case. I remember it was load disk space. I was telling me something anyway. I can't remember. I thought, well, that's interesting. I think Plateau has talked about this one of his episodes.
The messages under that system are delivered to your local message transfer agent, you know, because it comes through a chain of wherever message is coming from. And the MTA will then put it, says it's for that guy, so it puts it in a spool area, which is usually var spool mail, something or other with your username. Then when you run mail, it will pull the bin mail, then it would pull it out of there and stick it into your mail, whatever, however your mail was sent. So we had that, and there were various clients that let you, other than bin mail, something called Elm, I think, in those days. But we were using Alteryx at that point, and on Alteryx they were quite keen that you used a thing called MH, Message Handler.
Right.
An MH was a thing where it did the same thing. It would go and grab stuff out of your spool area and it would put it places. But it was not a single tool. It was a whole suite of things.
Right.
So there was one command called ink, which meant pull down the messages and stick them wherever. I think it would stick them in the inbox.
Oh, yeah.
But you could also say, oh, as you're doing that, run it through this filter. Mm-hmm. And the filter, you could then write filters in all sorts of fancy ways.
Cover. Yes.
Which said, so this is a mail from Charlie, so put it in the Charlie folder, and so on and so forth.
And you know, this is something I touched on before. I think some of the earlier systems were more sophisticated and clever, and have been dumbed down for the masses.
Yes. Exactly so. So I spent many, many years at work using MH, and then there was a tool called XMH, which was an ex-Windows, more GUI type thing, which let you manipulate your MH mail. And then I moved on to, what was it called? EXMH, which was a TCL/TK client.
Right.
Which was you could modify to the umpteenth degree, which did pretty much the same, but had lots more facilities in it.
Mm-hmm.
And as the filter, everybody in those days used a thing called Procmail, and Procmail would take a message and would parse it, get out all the headers, do all sorts of stuff to it, and you could make it. It was run by a configuration file, driven by it, and you could do things like, if I get a message from this person, then turn the message into a reply, send it back saying, got your message, thanks a lot.
God.
All within a recipe for Procmail.
Very clever.
I did that. I had my own help system.
And now from going to something like that, so configurable and so sophisticated, something now that's so dumb, must be so frustrating.
Well, the dumbest, I reckon, is blooming Outlook.
Oh, no,
Outlook
that.
Is
that.
Such, I won't say that bad word, but I was going to say, but it is appalling.
I'm forced to use it, and it's awful.
So
it's
was
awful.
I to some extent, but I managed not to use it very much, except for because we got meeting invitations through it.
Yeah.
Even Thunderbird could handle them and reply to them. And
right.
So,
I think you know, from my point of view, I think I started with, and I was trying, I think I mentioned before, and I couldn't remember what it's called. The first mail client I ever dealt with was Eudora, the Windows client.
Yep.
And of course, my brother at the time, he had, you have mail. He had Hotmail. So that was a starting point. But then, obviously, with Linux and all that, I discovered, what was the one you use? It's now Thunderbird actually.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Fortunately, Thunderbird can import Eudora mailboxes and stuff, which is surprising.
Yep.
So I was very pleased at that. And so I did use Thunderbird for quite a while, but I ended up eventually using just Gmail for the convenience of it all. You know, so I've gone
Well, The thing about the earlier mail stuff, which I still look back on with regret, that it's not generally, like, I mean, I could set it up and use it, but it'd be a bit of a pain. One of the things about it was you could rewrite the headers. So, I mean, the headers is just a chunk of text at the beginning of an email, which says things like from and to and subject and stuff like that.
Yeah,
and there's a lot of other gubbins in there that says where it came from and all that sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. I got quite good at parsing that because the Procmail tools, there's a thing called Formmail, which let you parse it and do stuff with it. But it was possible to add your own arbitrary headers. So you could put X label if you wanted.
Yeah.
And that would contain a label. And then you would have facilities within the suite of XMH, EXMH, whatever, saying, find me all the messages with this label or these labels. And so you could do all sorts of complicated Boolean analyses of it.
And then you can't.
And now you can't.
Come backwards, yes.
I know. And it's is email still relevant?
Yeah.
Well, I'm tempted to say bad words about this.
It used to be, but they've ruined it.
Yeah. Exactly. Because it's been destroyed, by my reckoning, in many, many regards, it isn't as desirable a thing as it was.
Yeah.
Because, you know, for me, it was a filing system where I could keep a lot of information in.
Yeah.
You know, things about keeping discussions with people, especially when somebody says, could you do this and by such and such a time? And you'd say, yeah, sure. And then you'd be working on it, and they'd say, you haven't finished yet. Yeah, but you said you wanted to buy someone. Oh, no, I didn't. Yes, you did. Here's the email that says it. So don't argue. And I used that so many times.
I get so many emails now coming in that it's just a nightmare. And what I fight with is you'll get messages about different topics and stuff, and they might be slightly unrelated, or they might be mixed and whatnot. So trying to keep them to the separate categories, if you could do that automated thing, that would help. I started using, I think I mentioned it, OneNote was just at work, you know, to solve that. And I would cut and paste bits of emails into a OneNote thread, and then I might have like Word document attachments or whatever, and maybe put a wee heading, this there was an email from such and such about this, blah blah blah, here's the text below. It's all manual, but it's all searchable, and you can find things, and you can help, and you can sort it the way you like. But of course the damn thing bloody well corrupted itself, you know. So I've got corrupt tabs within OneNote. It's mostly still okay, but when I looked up about it, there's quite a few folk complaining about, oh, my OneNote got corrupted. Yeah, that's quite common. Well, that's blooming useless. What's the point of a tool that's supposed to be searchable? Yeah. Like, we collect things.
My screwdriver melted when I was using it.
I think it puts it all in one huge big data file. That's probably part of the problem, and then it gets corrupted.
Well, people hated the MH philosophy. People say, look at that, it's junk. Because what it did was it made a file from every message, and it put them in, it had a folder concept built in, but it gave the messages numbers. So it just stuck it at the end of the folder as, you know, if there's 41 there, so this is 42.
All right.
And you could do things like shuffle around the numbers or reorder them date-wise. But mostly it would do that automatically. But the advantage to that was all the file stuff, you could write, you know, awk scripts and sed scripts and Perl scripts to deal with all this stuff in a very elegant way. It maybe wasn't as efficient in terms of, you know, storage space and stuff, but these are files, so if you wanted to add a header, you just went to the file with your sed script and said this header to go on all these messages.
It's I remember there was an article in one of the Linux magazines talking about OpenOffice, and they were comparing it to say something like a proprietary version like Word, for example, because what you can do, because you know it's just a zip file with text within it. So again, you could do awk sed scripts. You could, for example, if you're an organization and your name change, it had a name change, like my company has very many times, and we won't go into that, but you know, you could just run a script and it all gets fixed. You cannot do that with Word documents.
Because
you can't get into the binary data and tweak it. So it's
a weird thing.
And in fact, just the other day, I had an old Access database, and my boss he comes from a software background. Everything should be software background, and he wants everything to be sort of logged and put configured online and all that sort of stuff. And we've got a lot of paperwork stuff, and I said, you know, sometimes paperwork's better, and he won't accept that. Well, just the other day I found this old Access database, wouldn't let us open it, but I've got that, an A4 ring binder that's got that information in it. So there's that. It just proves that, you know, you can't open it anymore. It's on a company server and back to it, you can't open the bloody thing. You know, what good is that? You know, it's useless.
If it had been
a non-proprietary system, they could have opened it always, you know.
Yes. Yes. Low-flying aircraft, isn't it? Mm-hmm. So, yeah, the mail thing, is, listeners might realise that it's a subject that I ran on a bit.
Yeah.
So
now the next thing we were going to talk about is calendars, and it's probably kind of similar as well, because I was frustrated with it. I've got more used to it now. I use Google Gmail. I also use a calendar. I don't put huge amounts of stuff in it, but first I find it frustrating. But the cyan agenda was so much better, and I so much miss it. You know, it's more sophisticated and just nicer in general. You know, so yeah.
I had certainly hoped for better calendars as time went on.
Yeah.
We used to use a thing called iCal, which is a name that that predated the format iCal that people use for calendar, the underlying ISO format. And it was quite nice. It was a sort of X Windows display thingy, which merely displayed, I think it just displayed stuff. Maybe you could click on bits or something, but it was, I think it was driven by a config file behind the scenes. So you would edit that more than anything else. But it was just a nice thing to have in the corner of your window, and you know, and it would alert you. You should be in a meeting or that sort of thing.
So we use Skype in the office, but they recently introduced Teams, and so whereas, if I got this right, so Skype, it does integrate into Outlook, so you can you can set up a meeting request or whatever it is, but in Teams, it doesn't. So when how on earth could I, you know, the modern, it's got its own separate calendar.
Oh, great.
That's lovely. Yeah,
so you can't import eggs or anything. Yeah, there's no doubt. It's crazy. I actually use Thunderbird's calendar, which originally was called Lightning, I think. I don't know whether it has a separate name now, but it's an integrated thing. But that's just a calendar. You can go to it, click on a day cell, and add an event in there, you know. So your visit to the dentist can be there, and you can put alarms on it.
One of the things, a nice touch I liked about this, the sign was, so if you've got a heading for your calendar event, or go to the dentist, and then you could add a note. So if you add a note, what happens is it adds 3 dots to the end of the title. So at a glance, I've got other information I need to look at in there. I now do that manually myself. So if I do it in Outlook, I put 3 dots in there, so I know. It's just nice touches like that, you know.
That's a nice feature.
Yeah.
But I mean, I do that. I mean, I had an event come up recently, or I could see it in the future, which was to get the bus to Glasgow for a pod crawl. which is still in my calendar,
and it's due
in about July. But I'd written the instructions for where to go to catch the bus, what frequency they arrived at, and all that sort of stuff, and that had been there for years.
Very handy.
And I was going to Glasgow for another reason, and it was really useful. You know, so my calendar was also an event-related note thing. Is seems to me to be a highly desirable feature to have.
Absolutely.
I must admit, I did quite enjoy the fact that FOSDEM was on in early February in Brussels, and there's a client that you can run on your phone. I've got the Android version of it, so you can see all the events, and you can say, I'm interested in that one, I will attend this, and it goes, and you can set it up anyway to write your Google Calendar to say, are you going to be at this event? So you get alerts from the Google Calendar thingy to say, you're supposed to be at this meeting. I've used that in real life, because to get to meetings at FOSDEM requires a bit of legwork to get from across the university campus to find the place. But you know, just sitting at home and watching the thing in real time on the video feed, that was really useful. So you know,
is that like an open source project that wrote that's very
Helpful. And presumably the API to add stuff like that to the Google Calendar is generally available, you know. So there'll be permissions issues for your calendar, no doubt. But but still, you know, those sorts of things I find immensely useful. That would be the sort of thing I would want to be using all the time.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I effectively do, but
yeah. I think Ken not mentioned something about the last, what was the thing? The first thing he was at, did he not see? I was just listening about that. This morning, because you said it was a bit quieter than previously, I think you said.
Yeah, I was surprised he said that. I thought it was going to be, because the estimate from the FOSDEM organisers was there were going to be 8,000 people there.
Yeah.
I don't know how they work that out.
Yeah,
whether it's just a line on a graph that happens to be going up at 45 degrees.
Yeah,
I don't know how, it didn't seem to be quite as many. It used to be about 4,000 or 5,000 when I first started going to them, and that was full. 8,000 would be nightmare. You wouldn't be able to, you know, be shoulder to shoulder as you walk from one place to another.
So we'll move to our next topic, you think?
I could go on. I should shut up about it.
No, it's okay.
In fact, I should do some shows on why email is crap nowadays how it was better in the old days.
We could learn a lot from that, I think, actually.
So we were going to talk about having discs that conk out and why they do. And
So I think I'm starting to suffer a little bit of bit rot. And so if I understand this, I remember reading about this, it's something that I can't, you may well know more about it than me, but it's the way that flash devices need to be refreshed, because so they get heated up, the cells of the individual bits that make up the individual sectors or whatever they are, they get heated up, and do they not maybe flatten out over time, and then the rot sets in, and if you don't refresh, to refresh it, all you would need to do, I guess, is just to copy the whole SD card to some other media and then write it back, and that would just refresh. I think that's all you need to do.
Okay.
But of course, if you don't do that, over time, something get cups between the ones and the zeros, because it flattens out. Mm-hmm. I think that's what's going on. And what I was going to say is, I know that I noticed several months ago, maybe even a year ago or so, my Raspberry Pi under my television, I've got Open Alec on it, and it's starting to, sometimes it doesn't boot up properly, it won't boot up. It's occasional, and all the other wee glitches happening. So I think what's happening is that I'm getting bit rot there, and it's slowly breaking the thing. And I think I had an issue with bits of audio missing from stuff on my upstairs Pi. So yeah, I think maybe I'm starting to see bit rot, but I still have never had any failure in me, so they have been pretty robust to be fair.
Yeah, I haven't had too many problems with SD cards that I'm aware of anyway. Maybe I did have one in the early days, my earliest Pi. What was that? The A, the Model A or something.
Model A, yeah.
Way back in the in time. Mm. That sort of stopped working. Mm. And that's all I can say about it. Mm. It seemed to be of the SD card. But that was an early SD card where I wasn't so knowledgeable about what type to buy. It was probably some old rubbishy thing I'd had out of a camera or something.
Yeah. I know. Well, funny you should say it, and I may have mentioned before, but my wife's friend, she goes on a lot of holidays, and she just takes an SD card and a flash card and just fills it up.
Mm-hmm.
And then she says, well, that's this holidays. And she's got all these cards she's filled up and never ever backs them up. And I'm thinking, it's going to go bad.
yeah, that does sound like
it. But there I've got CDs that are all filled with pictures and stuff, and I wonder how many of those are readable.
Indeed, whatever you choose, it's going
to... They reckon that for audio, I'm sure I read somewhere that the best archiving, the media they reckon for backing up audio, they reckon VHS, it's like it had high quality, it's almost close to Nikon stereo sort of thing. So the audio quality of these super VHS recorders were actually very high, and that you could store a tape like that for many, 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 many years, and it'd be very safe, much better than a CD. And the other thing that I think hard drives are pretty robust, and well, let's say some makes more than others. And I do remember that, I don't know if you remember the story, that back in the early days, Google decided they were going to use a hard disk array to just, and they were just going to use banks of standard hard disks.
Mm-hmm.
And they did data analysis on the failure rates and stuff, and they wouldn't, they thought it was unfair, I'm sure I've mentioned this before, they were unfair to say which makes failed, which didn't, because they thought it would be uncompetitive and all that.
Mm-hmm.
But they said that certainly there were certain things that they noted for, if they last for over a year, then they go on forever, basically. Mm. And the drives that run the hottest are more likely to be the ones that fail, things like that.
Okay.
So he's got a thing on it.
Yeah.
So I've got a Western Digital My Passport 250 gigabyte hard disk, mm-hmm. and I use it all the time. Regularly, and it has never failed. In fact, one point I thought it had failed, and I was batting up and down the floor trying to get this to work again. It had been in the back of a bike from Edinburgh to Dalkeith a couple of times, a push bike, and it still works, you know. And I have all my drives I've bought have been Western Digital Passport drives,
mm-hmm.
and my father-in-law has bought some. And none of our drives have failed so far. So
yes, I think it depends on which of the models you've chosen, does it not? Because I've certainly had experiences with the Black range, Western Digital Black, that are designed for, they're more expensive and they're designed for long use. Mm. I think I've got one of those still running in my main machine. They have a colour. There's a blue and there's a green. There's the green ones are for.
Oh,
I don't know what the green ones are. I think they're for.
Are these things that go into computers? They're not like.
Yeah.
They're not like USB
caddy
things.
No. They're spin there. It all of their range of spinning discs and also their SSDs
mm-hmm.
that come under these categories. And I think you get different.
For example, if you got a Western Digital My Passport sort of thing,
mm-hmm.
what grade of drive would be in that? I mean, I don't know.
I don't know. I think that it is possible to answer that, but
I'm
not quite sure what the answer is.
Well, all I can say is none have failed, so I think that's not a bad.
Yeah, I've heard of people buying the things sold as Passport and then taking the disc out and saying, look, I've got a Black or something. I couldn't give you chapter and verse of that, but I've certainly seen that. In fact, it was recommended you got a better deal if you bought them through that route.
Oh, right. Then actually,
then buying them.
Interesting.
I've got my notes here all paper and I think I've just shuffled them.
I could have sworn that I wrote about that and I'm just looking and I can't see. I'm sure I did.
You can probably hear the paper being turned. I'm sure.
It was down the bottom, maybe.
It's in the audio, you can hear it. And also, we're in a car park, by the way, everybody.
So if you hear
I've got the windows of the car are slightly open because it's getting a bit stuffy. And there's a lot of people in the car park, so if you hear noises off, you'll know what it is. It's not sort of strangely hidden away in the back. Well, we are, actually. It's strangely hidden away in the back of a car park. We really ought to do a better job of these notes because what we've ended up doing is accumulating odds and ends over a period of months.
Yeah.
Things that want to be talked about.
That was it. Yeah, it was in the future upgrades I talked about.
Oh, okay.
So it was Western Digital Passport drive was bought in 2009. Making it 14 years old, the drive is 250 gigs and still in regular use. So yeah, we were going to talk about future upgrades. I was just going to say my father-in-law was going to buy some 4 terabyte Western Digital, another one. He just recently bought another one because he was concerned about chip shortages and whatnot.
Okay.
And it's even within my sphere of work, the electronics industry is in complete turmoil and day-to-day, hour-to-hour, things can change. It's a nightmare trying to get the components. And, you know, when you think about the complexity of the modern life, and even something as simple as a pump might have an electronic module or something in it. So if you can't get that specific specialised part, because in the past the components were like a TTL logic or whatever, and they were standard bits, and from those TTL logic, you connected in a certain way and it made a particular circuit, but now you get the whole thing built on a chip, and that chip only does that one job. So if you can't get that specialist chip for that specialist job, you're stuffed. So you could get a situation where you could imagine where a pumping station or something like that opens a valve or something like that, has this module on it, it goes down, so you can't get that chip from China, you can no longer pump water to the residency or something. I mean, that's insane. So you can see that all these complexities people don't think about,
So
there's not these, you just turn the knob and...
That's open, right. You know. It's complexity and also single points of failure.
Single point of failure, that's right.
That's been constructed because... Yeah. It's great. It's the cheapest route. Let's find the cheapest route. Is it resilient though? Yeah. Oh, we don't care about resilience.
Don't care about resilience. Well, that's the other thing that the product that I work on is really quite old and it uses TTL and you can still get a lot of the chips today. But the modern stuff that they're bringing out, the other projects, they can't get the parts anymore. And it's much newer.
Can
almost be out of date before they actually get the product out the doors.
Yeah. I know. I keep hearing people saying stuff like we've got so much reliance on X. I mean, GPS, for example. It's in everything, and it's a vital part of so much.
Was it something to do with hospital doors? Mm-hmm. Had something to do with GPS? So how the heck would you expect that have anything to do with GPS? So everything just falls. The bits of GPS goes down. It's incredible.
I know. It's like having, you know, your Nest thermostat or all these other IoT knickknacks in your house. Your house is running on these things, and it's dependent on some cloud, which one day will fail, or either will fail, or it's not economically viable anymore, and you end up with a house full of junk, and none of the doors will open, or the lights won't go on.
Well, that's a wee bit of an inconvenience. Imagine you've got a warehouse that's unimaginably big, no one person could navigate it. You've got so much stuff on it that nobody apart from a computerized system could retrieve the stuff. And you've got up and down the country. If that fails, how are you going to get stuff to the shops? How are you going to get shops to the people? You know, it's all going to go to hell. So it's scary, you know. People ever think about all of that, you know. It's mental.
I worked in a factory for a year to get enough money to carry on with my studies. I ended up being a warehouseman for a while, I got the job of, I was given a Dymo labeler, you know, the sort of crunchy ones.
Yeah, I had one.
Wow, it builds the muscles in your arm. And labeling all the bins and doing inventories and that sort of stuff. And that was all entirely manual. When people came to the front, it was a section of the factory. If people came to the front desk and said, have you got a left-handed widget? Then the guy'd say, oh, we've got three of those. And he'd know. You know, so
I mean, I even heard it that some of these big shopping centres that you go for food, they're constantly having a trickle stream of understand of lorries coming in. So if the shelves went empty, they couldn't refill them unless they closed the stores. And I don't know how long it would take them to fill if you empty a store, how long would it take to build it back up to stock again? Maybe it'd take a week, 2 weeks. I don't know. Would people starve? I don't know.
Often these places run with a night shift that comes in to do the restocking, because that's when the through, even though they might be open at night, they're still when the throughput is low.
I touched on it before, I should have mentioned it last time, was that my father-in-law worked for Scottish Gas, and he said that if the gas system's got to always run, if it stops, then you've got to go to every house and turn every single tap and valve off open it once or something like that. Could you imagine? Could you imagine? Because it's not designed to ever stop. It stops.
Oh, wow. The thing that bothers me, actually, and just because I just have thoughts that go around my head and won't go away, is about the day that the sun says, right, time for your coronal mass ejection, buddies.
Oh, yes.
And one of those hits us, like the one did in Canada. The one that blew up all the telegraph system back in the...
If that happened today, because we're seeing that if it hit something like America or Britain for that matter, that they maybe would never survive it, because you've got like substation transformers, and so they take the grid voltage down to 240 volts for a region. Now, I don't know how many they've got of these in store, maybe they've got 10 for the whole country or something like that in stock, and it takes a year to restock that, maybe 2 years to restock that. If suddenly the whole country's transformers fail all up down the country, you couldn't replace them. People would starve, people would die. It would just be yep. Armageddon, yep. basically, yep. you know. And yeah.
It's another case of, yeah. you know, not exactly single point of failure, no. but not enough
yeah.
failure-proof things.
And the thing is, I believe that, I could be wrong, but I feel if I read into this, and it did worry me this as well, actually, I've thought about this. I think, you know, things can be hardened against that. And I think, for example, Germany's done that.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, cheap Britain hasn't done it because
we
do everything in the cheap, so we didn't. We haven't done that, you know. So yeah, so that's
not making enough profit from doing that.
No, that's all about profit, as you say. Yeah.
So
it's, teach upgrades. What we were
that's a fascinating subject.
We've
gone away from our agenda a tiny bit, haven't we? So have we said enough about disc failure-y things and stuff?
Probably have, aye.
My
just check it, yeah.
recorder's reading 44.
Oh, you've got it on it already. Well, that's fine. That's good. You can see that. That's good.
I'm just trying to keep this. Yeah. It'll truncate a bit.
Yeah.
But I think we can go on for another chunk of time.
A few chapters, and maybe is that have we got time to cover a bit of that then, maybe? So basically, all my Pis are running old versions of Raspbian or Debian or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a go at Christmas time. The year before I did, and I may have done a show on it. And I did the same thing this Christmas. I had a go to upgrade my Pi. And I planned to do two Pis, and it failed. You know, I can't remember how far I got. I got so far, and it just didn't work. And I gave up in disgust. So I just went, because I take an image of the whole SD card, I could just write it back onto the SD, and it was back where it was. I just said, well, I just love it the way it is, and I can't contemplate rebuilding it. It's just it's too much hassle.
Yeah, so, yeah. I've done a similar thing, really.
Yeah.
I've got Pis which have failed because they can't upgrade anymore because the jump from Raspbian to Raspberry Pi OS is not, I don't think it's a thing you can automate.
Right.
So it just needs the whole thing being. Yeah. I have actually done two of them and they're up and running, but I've not yet because it's a case of, you know, it's a nuke and pave thing. You're blitzing the whole lot and then having to rebuild it.
But the trouble is, the two Pis that I want to upgrade, so one's got a, what's it called now? It's Command and Display, CAD, Command and Display add-on board, which basically has an LCD display
and then
buttons. Now, so that's really useful because I can start and stop podcasts. I can check the queue status. It's just really, really handy. And it controls my Pi upstairs. And the Pi upstairs has got another add-on board that's just got it's a simpler board, and it's got buttons, so I can again start and stop the play.
Mm-hmm.
I could do other various things without actually having any display on the unit. So it's headless, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the upstairs one, I could get by with just nuking it and forgetting about the buttons. It's not that big a deal. But I wouldn't want to lose my Command and Display one because I wrote a Python script and all that for it.
Yep,
and it's nice. So.
And is it not compatible with?
I don't think it is
with the Raspberry Pi OS.
I don't think it's the latest
one.
Oh
no, I see. Yeah. So is the thing discontinued? Is it not a product anymore?
Yeah, I think they have maybe a newer one now. That sort of thing. Yeah.
So yeah, this would need you to write something to interface
rewrite it again.
Which is going to be quite a thing.
I'm just using it for a long time now. I've just used it as almost a piece of. I don't even see it almost as a project anymore. It just works. You put it on, the display comes up. So yeah, I just
that's great. But it's also one of the most dangerous things that you can do. It becomes part of your everyday life, and then all of a sudden it goes away because somebody says, right, upgrade, or we're not making this anymore, and you're stuffed. That's irritating, isn't it? Yes,
this is it. So
the one of the projects I would like to do, and I've started but haven't moved on with it, got a few of these Raspberry Pi Pico chips, which are quite powerful for single sort of microcontroller thingies. And I got one which came in, or you had to fit it into a little keyboard with a bunch of maybe, I can't remember, how many keys, 12, something like that. Just ordinary keyboard keys, but in a little on a little board. And then it's got a USB output. So things like, I mean, you could write a fair bit of software on that Pico, because you can run Python versions, or you can write stuff in C, C++, I think, as well. But if you've got projects like needing to control stuff through extra buttons or something like that, maybe something like that, they're not massively expensive.
No.
Something like that might be the way to go.
Yeah, long term, maybe.
Aye.
And I mentioned my OpenELEC thing, and again, that's that's getting really long in the tooth, and there's a bit because of the bit rot, it's getting a wee bit iffy. Mm-hmm. And I don't have the time to spend on things. I think that's the trouble with a lot of Linux products, spend so much time on them. And I loved it and enjoyed it back in the day when I had the time. Mm-hmm. And I was even contemplating, you know, I'm not sure, I think it's a 3B I've maybe got under the television, I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. But I had contemplated like an Android box or something like that. But I think I'll just keep this thing as long as I can and see where I go from there. Maybe just upgrade the distribution on it. Because I think the problem is OpenELEC, the version I've got, it doesn't do 3D acceleration as well. So that's a bit of a... But yeah, it's good enough.
It's all too easy to get into those things. I was running a one of those model... Was it the A Plus, the one that came out a couple of years ago, which is just a minimal board with no Ethernet, or it's got Wi-Fi, maybe Bluetooth, and no Ethernet, and but it's quite powerful.
There's so many models. That's the thing.
I had that on the back of an old monitor, and I was running Magic Mirror.
Oh yes, have you seen that?
And that was great. That was really nice to have that because it would tell. I could even get the bus timetable off it, and it would tell me all about the weather and the time and all that sort of stuff.
You still have it?
No, because the Pi needed that upgrade, which I haven't done yet. And then it looked as if that project that I was basing it on had gone into some sort of decline. So unless you'd be prepared to go in and dig around with the code and get it all up and running again, I think maybe there are people who've said, oh, look at this, it's going down the tubes, let's bring it back to life again. There might still be projects like that around, which would be great. But my son's learning JavaScript and Node.js, which is what it's written in, so I could maybe ask him for a bit of advice.
Because you never know, it might not be that daunting to
but it's a project that it doesn't do what I used to do.
It was really useful.
And I've got to go and mend it, and I've also got to mend that and that and that and that and that, so I'll get to it.
I'm like that myself. This is it.
It's prioritizing these things can be a pain.
On my OpenELEC thing, I noticed one day that I came back from holiday, or when I came back anyway, I turned the Pi on and I found there was no network connection. I thought, what's going on here? It turned out that I had the Volo home plug, plugs, and it had failed. One had failed because one was okay, so one on its own is useless because obviously to get a network connection, you need one at one end and one at another end.
So it goes through the mains. It's a mains Ethernet type thing.
Here's the strange thing. I unplugged the Ethernet connection from the Pi and it reconnected to my Wi-Fi, and I thought, I was getting a network connection. I thought, how's that? And then I thought, it must be through Wi-Fi. And I thought, this is a newer version of the Pi. It's got Wi-Fi in it. And I must have set it up all that time ago, forgotten, and then back to the network plug again. So that was a nice surprise. So that was a very easy fix.
Wi-Fi's, I mean, that Magic Mirror thing was a Wi-Fi based thing for obvious reasons. And I had been running a Raspberry Pi camera in the window. I bought a little board from Pi Hut.
Oh, yes,
which you could stick on the window, and it took a Pi Zero W on the back of it and a camera on the front of it. So you could use it as a means of taking pictures
of
what was in the garden whether the postman actually called or something. Whatever you wanted.
You're digging data laws and all that. Of course, you wouldn't do that.
No. But you could have done. It would go on there, and it would take a picture of it outside.
Very useful,
The camera, I screwed the camera on that particular one, but still. Yeah, but that was running on Wi-Fi, and it was taking pictures on every 15 minutes, and I was copying them to our main machine and stashing away, making little movies out of them.
Very good.
Anyway, that's digression.
What else have I got? My old, next thing I've got is my old desktop PC is getting very, very old, and it's like, again, all my stuff's getting old, and it's like me myself really, I'm feeling very old. So.
I know.
It's actually running Ubuntu 18.04. LTS, but they've got security updates to 2028. It's amazing. Incredible. So it's got that. It's got Windows 7 on it, which I make sure if I ever, I can't remember the last time I booted them or something, but when I do, I make absolutely sure the network connection's unplugged, you know. But I use that to occasionally to program the odd amateur radio bit of gear I've got. Other than that, you know, it's a Dell OptiPlex 780 with 4 gigabytes of RAM, would you believe? So yeah, it's pretty low spec. I think I'm maybe going to have to upgrading. You know, it was one of these mini desktop things that businesses use, and it runs really quiet, really cool. It's been rock stable, you know. But yeah, it's getting too old now.
People are pushing those, suggesting those as being good, a good place to run if you want to get into these IoT systems. Right. What's the one open? There's one that you run as a server that knows about all your IoT kit.
Right.
And people have been saying that these are actually quite good. I'm not sure if it's that exact model, but in the same area, that they're not very heavy on power usage.
Right.
And so you could run them 24/7.
Right.
Without too much difficulty, and they've got enough power to run quite a lot of the code that's needed to.
Well, I mean, I've actually been able to do, like I did an episode on video editing, so I can do it. So I can do video editing on it as well.
It's quite a fun machine in many ways.
But I mean, I use it less and less because I tend to just, of course, we have cold in Scotland and we've got the electric heating as well. So you think, oh, it's too cold to cut that. Cold room, so you sit downstairs and I'll use a tablet or something, you know, or a laptop or something, you know. So
my main computer is in the downstairs, and I've got an extension to my house, which is where it is, sort of dining and kitchen extension, and it just so happens that it's south pointing and it's got a flat roofing, felt roof. So on a day like today, which is very nice and sunny for our listeners, that space warms up.
You don't need
any heating at all. It's actually really
nice.
On a bitterly cold, windy day, it's not all that nice. Just sit there under a blanket. These are the issues that we have these days.
I think we've maybe covered. The next section we're going to talk about YouTube, but that's maybe going to hold new things. So I don't know what are we on. We're on. Is that
coming up to? 56 minutes on my recorder.
That's maybe.
We did have it running.
Yeah, that's maybe a good place to stop. Maybe this is anything else you were thinking of bringing
the,
up.
We did make a list of YouTube channels that we were sort of recommending. Had we got to that, I don't know, would we have talked about it over much? Because most people tend to do their YouTube lists on HBR with just saying, you know, this is good, you should watch this if you like that type of thing.
Yeah.
Maybe we could turn what we've assembled into, you know, notes with a little bit more text to them.
Maybe,
I think some of these might be of interest.
Okay.
I mean, unless you want to take yours away and make a show out of it.
No. Ken would love that, but
I know. It's not always easy to find the time.
It's funny enough. I said to Dave, I've got a show that I'm trying to pull together just now, and it's all recorded. It's all done. But it's the show notes. That's slowing me down. You know, it's getting the notes themselves take time. You remember that Claire too? He used to say, "What's the point?" Back in the day, you know, you say, "What's the point of the show notes?" But there is, of course, there's nice to have.
Because I come from a sort of academic related background, it was really important to have textual material to go with stuff.
Yeah.
So it was drummed into it. So I tend to write the notes first and then talk around the subject with the notes in the sort of center.
It's a good way to do it.
Come back. People have said, you know, the notes are so helpful.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to make a book out of one series I did, which I think I mentioned in the previous Tell Me Now.
That is the scripting one or something, isn't it?
This one is Said.
That
would
be really good.
I've got a book together. But it's a PDF. I wanted an index in it because things as complex as that need an index. So I can make an index with PDF. It's actually quite good. But who wants PDF? Well, you know, you could live with it.
Yeah.
But I really want to be able to make an EPUB with an index. And at the moment, I haven't found a foolproof, Dave-proof method of doing it. So I will get there. Yeah. I will get there.
I've got a Said book on O'Reilly Pocket book. I think actually.
Yeah.
Because I don't find the time these days to I've got the Said. I've got Auk.
Mm-hmm.
I've got. The best one, the one I liked the best, was there was one on Pocketbook and Linux, I think it was.
Mm-hmm.
And I recommend, if you're starting off on Linux and you think, well, what are all these commands that are available to us? You've got this, the wee Pocket Linux book, And I think it's based on Red Hat, but you know, the command line tools that are really the same across all the distributions, you know, the core utilities or whatever. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I'll say for text editing, here's a group of things you do for text editing, a group of things for searching or whatever mm-hmm. it is. Mm-hmm. And if you, it doesn't take that long, maybe good toilet book, you know, so you can use a few pages out every time, you know, and you know, and I've read it cover to cover a number of times, and it means you can say, oh right, I could use awk for that, I could use head for that, yeah, cut, yeah, whatever it is, and you get to know the commands, because if you don't know what you can do, you don't know, then you find something useful to use it for.
It's not always easy to ask the question, what's the best way of turning this text into multiple columns those sorts of things.
Yeah.
I mean, it is possible, it's more possible to do it now because you can do a Google search and often get that.
Yes,
but you have to fight your way through the answers, some of which will be relevant and some not. Yeah. But it's good to have that knowledge of, you know, here's all the tools in the toolbox. So if you need to knock a nail in, don't use a screwdriver, you know, that type of thing. All right.
Yeah.
So, shall we call it quits
point?
I think it's just turned 1 hour and 1 minute, according to this, I think. So, we'll we'll call it quits.
Yeah.
And we'll do this again at some point.
Look forward to another haggis roll.
Yeah. Yeah, just time it better if you want something else.
But, a wee footnote on our notes for that. Next time.
Okay. I'll switch this off. So goodbye, everybody, from Edinburgh, and a nice sunny day. Not particularly warm, but
surprisingly so.
But the sun is strong, so
it's
quite cozy.
For change, yes.
Good. Okay.
So bye for now then.
Bye.
You have been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. Today's show was contributed by a HPR listener like yourself. If you ever thought of recording a podcast, you can click on our contribute link to find out how easy it really is. Hosting for HPR has been kindly provided by anhonesthost.com, the Internet Archive, and rsync.net. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution 4.0 International License.